I'm Dan Runcie, and you're listening to Trapital, where we're going to break down some of the biggest surprises of the streaming era. Streaming has changed music in a number of ways. You can hear it in the length of songs, which type of songs are more likely to become popular versus others, but then you also hear it in the songs that have been released and have come out for decades, that have taken a new life on platforms like Spotify, YouTube, and others, where how people listen and watch music has morphed to how songs can monetize and also continue to reach new audiences. For instance, if I asked you to guess which Kanye West song is his most streamed song on Spotify, what would you guess? My guess would have been stronger, but when we look at the data, it's actually Heartless, which recently surpassed Stronger as Kanye West's most streamed song. If we look at Eminem, if you ask me, I probably would have guessed that Lose Yourself is his most popular song, but it's actually Without Me. But it's a reminder that we're all in our little bubbles, especially when it comes to music. Some songs that are everywhere for some of us barely scratch the surface for others. And that's what today's conversation is about. You're going to hear me and Zach O'Malley Greenberg dig into the streaming data. We're going to dig into some of the most popular songs from the 80s, 90s, 2000s, 2010s, and today, and point out those songs that, for one reason or another, may stick out more than we think. And if you're listening to this show, you might hear a few surprises too. So come join us as we take a trip down memory lane and look at how music has continued to evolve in the streaming era. Let's dive in. This episode of Trapital is presented by State Farm. When you start a new business, your first reaction might be to say, woohoo, yes, or booyah. But one thing to say that could be a huge help is, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, State Farm will be there with the coverage that fits your need, whether your business is growing or just open its doors. State Farm agents are small business owners too, so they know what it takes. They can help you create an insurance plan that fits your small business needs and budget. And when you need help, State Farm is there to answer your small business questions or help you file a claim and get you back in business. With State Farm, you can worry less about the unexpected and focus more on your business. With a State Farm agent, you know someone is helping you achieve your goals. And just say, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Hello, podcast listeners. I have a question for you. What if you had a window into the digital startup world? What if you could ask the tech veterans what it feels like to create a world-class product? How to recover from critical mistakes? How to scale your solution to the masses? How do you get from an idea on the back of a napkin to a fully functioning product? What if you could hear the human stories about how they delivered technology? What if there was a show where you could hear those stories?
This is Code Story, a podcast bringing you interviews with tech visionaries.
Spent 6 months moonlighting.
There's nothing on the back end.
Who share what it takes to change an industry.
I don't exactly know what
to do next.
Took
many goes to get right.
Who built the teams that have their back.
A company is its people.
The teams help each other achieve
more. Most proud of our team.
Keeping scalability top of mind.
All that infrastructure was a pain.
Yes, we've been fighting it as we grow.
Total waste of time.
The stories you don't read in the headlines.
It's not an easy thing to achieve, mind
you. Took it off the shelf and dusted it off and tried it again.
To ride the ups and downs of the startup life.
You need to really want it.
It's not just about technology.
All this and more on Code Story. Make sure you subscribe to the Code Story podcast today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the podcasting app of your choice. And thanks again for listening.
All right, we're here today to talk about streaming surprises. This is our deep dive look at the streaming data on Spotify and YouTube, and I'm joined by Zach O'Malley Greenberg. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here as always.
I'm glad that you're interested in this topic too, because we're both born in the 80s, we're both fans and have a pretty wide range of music tastes and have a pretty good sense for what was popular at particular points. But when you look at the data, there's a lot of stuff that you would expect. But when you see certain songs that you would either expect to perform better or ones that came out of nowhere and performed, there's so many reasons why a song can have different performance. But that's what made this conversation fascinating.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about the most streamed song in Spotify or YouTube history. They have not been around forever. So it's a measure of what holds up best over the past decade or so. And it doesn't factor into obviously the historical consumption that occurred whenever whatever song came out, obviously, if there were a way of doing that, and you could capture the listens that were going on with Thriller at the moment Thriller came out, you'd have a pretty different list. But again, this is streaming. This is not album equivalent. It's a particular type of data. It's got some interesting revelations nonetheless. So I'm stoked to get into it with you, Dan.
I'm glad you mentioned MJ too, because that was a bit of the origin behind this, because you and I had done our winners and losers of 2024 episode at the end of the year. And one of the things we talked about towards the end was Sony's acquisitions of the Michael Jackson and Queen catalogs. The dollar amount they were valued at was similar, but Queen performed much better than Michael Jackson on Spotify when you look at the most popular songs, especially Bohemian Rhapsody. But when you look at YouTube, it was very different, where Michael Jackson does much better. And of course, Michael Jackson has some of the most iconic music videos we've seen, but there are a number of reasons why both Queen and MJ's legacies have endured in different ways in the 40 plus years since they made a lot of their most popular music.
Yeah. Also looking at how much that music is consumed as opposed to present day music, it's kind of wild how quickly consumption fades all around. It's always fun to dig into these numbers.
And to set the stage a bit, what both Zach and I did was we each looked through the data that was available and we each picked five surprises. We want to go chronological with this, so we'll start in the 80s. At least that's where the first data set was. To your point earlier, of course, if a song is released in the age of Spotify, it may have more streams than a song that was released before Spotify. So you really do have to compare things on an even perspective to have that apples to apples comparison.
It shocked me to see the most streamed song of the 80s on Spotify, which is Sting's Every Breath You Take. I thought it would have been something by Michael Jackson. The fact that it wasn't Thriller or Beat It or Billie Jean, and that it was Every Breath You Take, really did surprise me. And Sting, obviously an eternal all-time great. I could have seen that song in the top 10. That kind of knocked my socks off that it was number one. How about you?
Yeah, that song has always had this enduring appeal. The Police were part of that second British invasion in the 80s, Duran Duran. But I do think that that song performed especially well in the UK. And the UK, of course, you know, always one of the bigger markets. I did look at some data. Even in the US, it was the top song from 1983. That was still the year that Thriller was by far the most commercially successful album, because if that comes out at the end of 82, then that still has everything in 83. But when I looked at the data for Spotify, The Police, Every Breath You Take had 2.4 billion streams, but it's nearly getting 2 million per day, which is really impressive. And the next highest one for Michael Jackson, his top song was Billie Jean on Spotify, and Billie Jean has 2 billion streams, but it has just 1.1 million on a daily basis. So again, still performing quite well, but it's just a bit higher for The Police, Every Breath You Take. I think too, that maybe the other thing that's a bit surprising with this is that the Michael Jackson perspective, and whether it was Madonna or Prince, there definitely is a bit of that MTV vibe to it.
Yeah.
And not that Sting or The Police weren't on MTV, but they just weren't part of that. A lot of the MTV was more focused on a lot of these American artists that really pushed through, because again, I think that's why Michael's music probably does a little bit better on YouTube. These music videos themselves were just so much more iconic.
Prince, Madonna are extremely visually oriented artists. You could see why they're bigger on YouTube than Spotify. Again, these are Spotify numbers. It's different when you look at YouTube.
So let's skip forward a bit. Let's go to the 2000s, and The Killers' song Mr. Brightside came out in 2003, but in 2004 things really start to pick up, and it does end up charting as well in 2005. This song is the top three for the most streamed songs from the 2000s. It has over 2.4 billion Spotify streams, nearly 1.5 million per day. It doesn't have quite as many on YouTube, where it has 585 million. So there's definitely a bit of a discrepancy there. But to still have that high of a performance on Spotify is surprising. This is a Michigan grad. I've been in the stadium plenty of times when I've heard people chanting Mr. Brightside. And this was another song that, even though Brandon Flowers and The Killers were American artist. That song was pushed first in the UK and did extremely well there, and then came over to the United States and had success in both places. But similar to how you felt about expecting Michael Jackson or Prince or Madonna to be up at the list, when I think about the biggest rock songs of the 2000s that I probably would expect to see on a chart like this, Green Day, Boulevard of Broken Dreams, Linkin Park, In the End, or Nickelback, How You Remind Me. I know Nickelback's become a bit of a meme in recent years, but I probably would have expected all those songs to be more popular on streaming than Mr. Brightside. And some of them are pretty close. Linkin Park is pretty close. A lot of those songs do better on YouTube than they do on Spotify, and even better than Mr. Brightside does. But again, number three just seems higher than I would have thought for this song.
I'm going to have to disagree. I think Mr. Brightside is an all-time smash single. It's pretty timeless when you hear it come on and you're out at a bar at karaoke or something. It comes on. It sounds like it could have been made yesterday. And it is huge. I'm a big karaoke guy. If you ever go out to karaoke and you look on the lists of the most requested songs, it's always up there. And there's always like a bunch of people screaming it at the bar off key. It's very singable, although it's hard to sing well. Maybe it's shoutable. Some of the other songs you mentioned, In the End, love that track, but it feels of its moment. When you hear it, you're like transported to the early aughts, that particular era. I'm like taken back to high school, like very viscerally. And even though Mr. Brightside came out when I was in college, I don't associate it so clearly with a particular moment in time. I guess same for Boulevard or Broken Dreams. That's to me very much George W. Bush era. That album, American Idiot, was very much of a moment in a way that I think Mr. Brightside wasn't. Maybe it's my karaoke bias that's getting me here, but I'm not shocked that it is there. It reminds me, not sonically, but more like in the cultural space it fills, of Living on a Prayer. It's like a thing that people love to sing toward the end of the night when they've had a couple too many and think they're actually good at singing. But it's up there. It feels good. You could shout it out. And yeah, I'm not surprised.
I hear you on the karaoke piece, and I also hear you on the timeless piece of it. I guess if you transport back to when you were in college and you were hearing Mr. Brightside then, did it feel as big in the moment?
Well, that's a great point, because it felt of a class of songs. I'm thinking Take Me Out by Franz Ferdinand, other new alternative rock music started to come out. It felt one of the big ones, but it wasn't clearly above the rest. Like when you heard Despacito, that song was clearly the number one song of the summer, the number one song of the year. But yeah, why did Mr. Brightside continue to be consumed in a way that something like Take Me Out by Franz Ferdinand did not? Both amazing songs, both screamy alt rock you could pop into. That's a good point. I don't really have an answer. Okay, here's the theory. I think Mr. Brightside was on Rock Band. Was it on Rock Band? Do we know? Do you remember?
I mean, that would apply to a lot of songs, even some of the ones that we've mentioned, but I get what you mean, though. Yeah, it was in both. It was in Rock Band 2, yeah. Rock Band 4, Guitar Hero 5, and Guitar Hero World Tour. It definitely had some staying power. There's a number of songs that didn't age well that are still in those games. But yeah, the song is great. I do want to be clear. I don't want to act like I don't love this song and get excited every time I hear it. What's your next one?
The next one is Coldplay's dominance of the 2000s on Spotify. There's 2000 to 2004. The top song is Yellow. From 2005 to 2009, the top song is Viva La Vida. And it's not even close. So if you look at Yellow, almost 2.8 billion streams with Viva La Vida, 2.5 billion streams. That's pretty wild to me. Yellow is not a banger, and yet it's ahead of all of this Eminem and 50 Cent and Maroon 5 from that era. That's really shocking to me, right? You don't usually see a mellow song like that being so dominant in a period with a lot of really strong artists and options. I guess I'm not surprised that Coldplay does well. I love Coldplay, but if you look at my most played artists or most played songs, it's a lot of Coldplay because I find I can write to it because yes, the lyrics are interesting and whatever, but it's not if you're listening to Kendrick Lamar where you really have to pay attention or you're going to miss something. With Coldplay, it's this kind of like ethereal sound and I find it very relaxing and it doesn't distract me from writing and editing. It ends up getting played a lot, but not everybody out there is writing and editing all the time. So I'm confused as to how it topped all those other acts that are maybe more bopping.
I think I'm less surprised by this because Coldplay, even though Taylor Swift's tour did capture all the headlines, Their tour became the second one ever to gross $1 billion worldwide. Now, of course, all that stuff influences streams. But I feel like you called out something, because even though not everyone is a writer, there's something about the Spotify core of lean back listening and just that experience. And I think that Yellow, Speed of Sound, and others, their music kind of fits that exact thing that Spotify just does so well. And maybe some of it is a bit Spotify and audio DSP specific in terms of the nature of listening behavior.
That's a really good point. If you dig a little deeper into these numbers from 2000 to 2005, you will find Yellow's number one. The Scientist is number six. Sparks by Coldplay, number 28. Clocks is at 40. I think this is also a case of people just putting the album on and then you get some of these songs popping up here. I mean, out of the top anything over 100,000 views from the era, there's 11 Coldplay songs, which is a significant portion of the songs on those albums. So it suggests to me complete album listening in a way that perhaps other artists don't get as much. It also suggests that could Coldplay's catalog be really the most valuable of all, because you have this extensive history, you have hits, they're still making music, they're getting streamed in a way that a lot of older catalog is not, and even 2000 is considered deep catalog, and they're still touring. I don't expect them to stop touring anytime soon. They played to 100,000 people in India earlier this year. If I were betting on catalogs for the next couple of decades, I would put some money on Coldplay.
Yeah, I think one of the things that doesn't get talked about a lot with streaming is the strong performance of a lot of the music that people that were born in the 80s or even in the early 90s grew up listening to, because those are the largest percentage of people that subscribe to music streaming services. So I do think from a recording perspective, it definitely would. On the publishing side, I think it may be a bit fuzzier. I'd be interested to see what that looks like. Would people be as interested in a Chris Martin biopic? Would people be as interested in like that, those types of rights and things like that? And not to say that I don't think that he's great or his music isn't interesting, but in the same way that people may look at like the value of doing something on a Freddie Mercury in his life, or doing like a Michael Jackson, if that even ever happens, on his life. So that's the one thing on the publishing side, but on the recording side, I'm with you.
Although Chris Martin has had some intrigue. He was married to Gwyneth Paltrow for forever, and they had their conscious uncoupling, and or I don't know, it felt like forever, but maybe it wasn't actually that long. And then J-Law and whoever else. And then I think he's buddies with Jay-Z. So there's some interesting stuff going on with Chris Martin outside the lines, as it were.
You want to see a Goop shout out, some Goop promo? Yeah, to see how, see what
not,
he felt
it's
about
not
that?
So scandalous. Yeah,
maybe, or the tabloids went wild when they named their kid Apple. I don't remember that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. That feels like a long time ago.
All right, so shifting gears a bit to the 2010s, we're going to talk about the song that is the seventh most streamed song on Spotify, and that is The Neighborhood's Sweater Weather. That came out in 2012, and again, this was a song that was at best a modest hit when it came out. Of course, I heard it on the radio, but this song took off for a couple of reasons. One, you could look at the TikTok memes and things like that that have continued to go viral. And whenever it is sweater weather and it gets cold, people use this song as something included in their videos with their Stitch or whatever it is. And that always gave it some type of seasonality, a very similar type of seasonality that people often talk about for Mariah Carey's All I Want for Christmas Is You. And that song, of course, does really well, but not as well as this song. Every year, there's plenty of articles about how much money Mariah Carey makes and all the touring and everything she's done around that. And I get it. The Neighborhood did not have 17 number one singles outside of this one hit the same way that Mariah Carey does. But the song also has become a bit of a bisexual anthem as well, because some people feel like both the name of the song title and some of the lyrics call out people either coming out. More power to The Neighborhood, more power to the songwriters and the performers that made that song possible and are clearly connecting bread from that. The song doesn't do as well on YouTube as it does on Spotify, but again, Spotify is the platform where a lot of that lean back chill music is, and some of the similar things that we're talking about with Yellow as well can apply to this song too.
Yep, totally. Lots of cultural touch points, personal, sexual, seasonal. It does hit a lot of different themes there. It surprises me that a song like It's Gonna Be Me, which always gets played. Exactly. That's definitely a seasonal anthem, but maybe that's a more specifically end of April anthem, and sweater weather could be anytime in the fall, September, October, November, US, but also you flip it for the Southern Hemisphere. So you also get some sweater weather in like Australia or South America in our winter. And then you get sweater weather all the time in San Francisco. It's so fascinating to me because if you had asked me the name before we recorded this show and you had played that song for me and asked me to name the artist, I would not have been able to name it. And I couldn't name another song by them. So it's kind of, yeah, like you said, it's surprising to see it number 7 on Spotify of all time for those reasons.
And similarly, for me, if you played that song, I don't think I would be able to have named, oh yeah, this is Sweater Weather. I probably would have said it's too cold or it's too close, whatever, however the hook goes there. I don't think I would have been like, oh yeah, Sweater Weather.
They break the Berry Gordy rule, which is that you have to shout out the name of your song in the chorus. And then at the end of the song, too, if you can. I don't even think they say the name Sweater Weather the entire song.
I don't think I remember hearing it either in the song. Just to repeat the stats, 3.5 billion streams on Spotify. Last I checked on the top 50 global on all of Spotify, it was in the top 50 for the most streamed songs day by day. And that's normally a playlist that has songs that are mostly coming out today, because in general, those are the songs that are getting tons of streams on a regular basis. And of course, we are looking at this now during sweater weather in the Western Hemisphere. So maybe it'd be a little bit different looking another time of the year. But yeah, this is the hit that continues to live on.
Yeah. And we should probably admit to the people who aren't watching the video version of this that Dan and I discovered we are wearing the exact same sweater in the same color.
You texted me before. You're like, wait, audio or video today? And I said video. And you're like, all right, we both knew that we were going to be recording this in video. And we both put on the same exact sweatshirt. And we're like, oh, is yours made by J. Crew? Mine is also made by J. Crew. Yes.
Yes. If you want to be a presentable dad doing a podcast, apparently you need a navy blue J. Crew sweater.
Let's take a break for a chart metric stat of the week. In the intro, I talked about how Kanye West's song Heartless surpassed Stronger as the most streamed song on Spotify. Well, we dug into some of the data, and what's even more surprising is that the song has more than doubled the amount of streams that it has on Spotify in the past year and a half. In May 2023, less than 2 years ago, the song had just around 750 million streams overall on Spotify. That's less than half the number that it has today. Heartless generates over 1.1 million streams daily on Spotify as of this recording, compared to just 630,000 for Stronger. This song continues to grow, and it looks like this trend is not slowing down anytime soon. Let's get back to the episode.
Okay, this is, I think it's the third most streamed Spotify song of all time. Of all time! Someone You Love by Lewis Capaldi. That was a big song, don't get me wrong, but it's number 3 all time? Behind Blinding Lights and As It Was? Like, how did that happen? This may be another TikTok thing, but still, of all the huge songs that have come out, especially in the past few years, this is not an A-list artist. This is not a song that if you said someone you loved, I'd have to think about it. If I heard it on the radio, I'm like, oh, yeah, that was a big hit. But I don't know. Up here with The Weeknd, Harry Styles, that kind of knocked my socks off, too.
One of those things, if you ask me to think of the top 4 songs, a lot of them do make sense, right? Blinding Lights felt like the biggest song during pandemic lockdowns. Ed Sheeran, Shape of You, he's a superstar, and it was his biggest hit, right? Yeah. Harry Styles, As It Was, that album was huge. That album did really well at the Grammys, too. This song just probably wouldn't have quite picked that up either, but I do think, again, there's probably a few things. There's a big regionality piece. I think this song did really well in the UK. It did really well at the Brits, and it just continued to have that kind of staying power. So I think that's another thing too, and this will come up with a few of the other songs we talk about. I think that the regionality piece can be unique because if we were to base this conversation off of the US only streaming performance, we would probably feel a little bit differently because it'd be like, oh, okay, that feels like more what I may have been used to. And I don't think that this song would nearly be as high on that list. But there's something again about the chillness, the vibe. Like if you just press play on a playlist and this song comes out, you're not gonna be like, wait, what? It's just something that kind of flows, and it's a good song. I'm definitely not gonna act like it isn't. It's definitely a good vibe. again, calling out this trend of things from the UK too. Lewis Capaldi is Scottish. We talked about Sting earlier and the Police. And even though The Killers is American and the artists are American, I'm pretty sure Brandon Flowers is from Vegas. That song broke in the UK. So I feel like there's something here with these songs that, or these artists too, that come from there. That's a song as big as this, nearly 4 billion streams on Spotify. Crazy. So my next one is very recent. It was a song from 2024. If you live in the United States, it was probably hard to feel like you could escape this song. And that is Kendrick Lamar's Not Like Us. Luminate had just released their 2024 end of year data. And if you look at the on-demand streams for audio and video combined, Not Like Us is the number one song listed there. And that tracks with things I've heard even anecdotally. You see it in the memes. You hear about it all the time. I walk down the street in different cities in California, other parts of the country. I hear this song playing from people's radios. But again, the global versus domestic thing for the US, you take a step back, you look at Luminate's data on the global perspective for the top 10 songs they listed, audio only, Not Like Us is not there. Kendrick Lamar isn't even in the top 10. And a lot of the other songs that were on that list were pretty similar, where you looked at them where, okay, if a song has enough push to be the number one song in the United States, you'd assume it probably has enough push to do as well from a global perspective. And Not Like Us wasn't quite like that. I think there's a number of reasons that we can likely get into. Part of that is Kendrick Lamar and lyrics. But I think the biggest thing is that this is a diss song, and a diss song itself is something that is very much rooted in American culture. And even though Drake is not American, but this is something that is very relevant to us as Americans here. It almost makes me think of movies in a way where, if you look at some of the domestic versus global box office, where the Star Wars movies, for instance, relatively for Disney, they over-index in America because United States and people from America care more about Star Wars than the rest of the world. But you look at that on Marvel, it kind of flips, where the Marvel movies often do much better internationally because there's just less of that context.
So what you're saying is that Kendrick is Star Wars and Drake is Marvel?
Not that Kendrick is Star Wars and that Drake is Marvel, but more that Bruno Mars and Lady Gaga Die with a Smile is Marvel.
Yeah, that's definitely,
or Sabrina Carpenter Espresso is Marvel. Like, yeah, songs that had similar types of streams in the US, but globally, the pop singles that weren't referencing American culture and didn't have complexity of lyrics like Kendrick Lamar did much better globally.
Yeah. First of all, that song, talk about bangers. It gets in your head. It's just that over and over again, but you just want more of it. I think one of the reasons it did so well is because, unlike basically every other song we've talked about, this song was like must-see TV. You have to tune in and hear what Kendrick has to say. It was an evolving beef. It was this rapid fire exchange. I mean, it was all over pretty quickly in the end, but I've never had more people asking me about hip hop. I had at the peak of this Drake Kendrick beef in like 15 plus years covering it. It captured people who were not paying attention to hip hop and it made them interested. And I think that's always good for hip hop. I do think that the beef got a little ugly, and we talked about J. Cole in some ways the winner by bowing out of it. But now that the dust has settled a little bit, we don't really remember the ugliness perhaps as viscerally. Here's Kendrick playing the Super Bowl halftime show, and you would have thought Drake would have been the first hip hop act to do it solo ahead of Kendrick, but Kendrick managed to jump that pecking order. He has this top song in the Luminate report, even if it's not global. It obviously took him to another level commercially. But like you say, globally, his lyrics are just really intricate. And much like we talked about earlier with Coldplay, you can't just put them on in the background and work. You want to analyze it and you want to get in there. And there are all these hidden meanings. Drake is at the opposite end of the spectrum. I think much like Marvel, translates to different languages, and you don't really need to understand exactly what he's saying, and he's not packing it in so closely anyway, but it's more about the vibe. The monetizable mid, it makes sense to me that this song did well. I'm still surprised that it did so well in the US, that there were that many people paying attention, even though it was must-see TV, even though it was this sort of current event item. Although Drake would probably tell you that there were some other reasons that the song got as hot as it got, getting pushed and so forth.
Don't get sued out here. Don't get sued out here, Zach.
I'll leave Drake to fight that one out. I had two other things. I had one individual song and kind of a trend. This is the top radio song of 2024. And I want everybody out there to think about, like, what do you think was the top song on the radio in 2024. I would be shocked if you figure it out unless you actually read this report. It was Teddy Swims' Lose Control by a mile. The radio audience, top U.S. radio songs, the audience was 3.26 billion, about 500,000 more than Shaboozy's Bar Song Tipsy, and Post Malone and Morgan Wallen had some help, blah, blah, blah. There's a bunch of other stuff in here. Espresso, 2.2 billion. Taylor Swift, Cruel Summer, 2 billion. Right? Luke Combs, Fast Car, 2 billion. It was a mile ahead. And if you played that song for me, I would be like, oh yeah, that song. But if you'd asked me to name a song by Teddy Swims, I don't know that I could have named it. So I was so surprised by this that I texted my cool elder Gen Z cousin about it. And I was like, am I missing something here? And she said that it was really a TikTok phenomenon. You know, as we talked about, some of these have been driven by TikTok. But she said, only people under the age of 25 really love Lose Control. I bet that's who drives the conversation. That's who drives the consumption. What's shocking to me is this was the top radio song, right? And my cousin thought that it was because perhaps radio is trying to reflect back what the younger audience wants in order to remain relevant. That actually made a lot of sense to me.
This isn't a song that really crept up in my radar the same way that Not Like Us or Espresso or a Bar Song Tipsy or I guess even Chapel Roan Hot to Go or a song like that. The other thing though, and this is probably where we're similar, the radio piece is, I can say for myself and probably assume a bit on your end, I don't listen to the radio nearly as much as I did when I was younger. We live on the coast. We live in cities where we don't need to be in cars on a regular basis. If I'm listening to things audio, I'm probably more likely to do it on demand in some type of way, whether it's on my podcast player, whether it's music that I'm choosing to listen to, then a playlist goes there. So I'm really only listening to the radio if I'm in and out of a car that I'm either using or an Uber or something like that, which isn't every day by far. So with radio type of stuff, especially now, I always take that with a grain of salt and I'll try to look at some data, be like, okay, because I know I'm really in a bubble on this one. But what's your take on that?
I don't know, man. I have a car. I don't drive it a ton. I listen to the radio. My 2.5-year-old daughter loves listening to music. Yeah, maybe it's this like coastal radio isn't playing Teddy Swims, but
not that I don't think coastal radio is playing Teddy Swims. I'm sure Z100 is playing Teddy Swims, but how often do you listen to Z100 is more my question.
Not very often. Yeah, but usually in the car, I'm just flipping from whatever has gone into a commercial to the next real song. So you would think that it would have happened upon Teddy a little bit more here. But again, I'm not in the car that much. But yeah, I really like this idea that radio is trying to appeal to this younger crowd. If you look at the numbers on TikTok, the number of videos that have included the song in it, it's something like 500,000. And then you multiply those by some of them are getting millions of views. But maybe radio programmers are looking at what's popping on TikTok and they're like, oh, we should put that on here because clearly that will make us relevant to the younger audience. My final surprise was looking at the demand audio streaming by decade. 2020s account for half of all on-demand audio streaming. Maybe that's not a surprise. The 2010s account for 30%. The 2000s account for 10%. So 50 plus 30 plus 10, that's 90. So anything recorded before 2000 is 10%. The entire previous history of music is 10%. If you want the breakdown, the 90s are 4.7%. The 80s are 2.2, the 70s are 1.8, the 60s are 0.7, all others are 0.7. So that's Elvis, the Beatles, Michael Jackson, Madonna, Whitney Houston, Queen, all these bands, Sting, The Police, Pink Floyd, Bruce Springsteen. That's the vast majority of all of their work is contained in that 10%, right? And if you were to do a comparison on the catalogs that have sold for nine figures and juxtapose that against the consumption that those eras are driving, even including these extremely valuable catalogs, you would get like wild pointing in opposite directions, right? If these sales are being driven by consumption, which obviously it's not just streaming that drives value of these catalogs, it's sync, it's publishing, it's, you know, all these other things. Obviously, we could break it down to recorded music catalogs versus publishing catalogs, but still, it is wild to me that all this money is being spent on music that people are not listening to. As we've talked to, yeah, like people are consuming Michael Jackson and Queen, but not in anywhere near the amount of quantity they're consuming modern artists. And obviously the question is, who has the staying power? Will anybody from the past couple of decades have even the staying power that an act like Michael Jackson or Queen has now? But if you go back to our Coldplay conversation, Coldplay does seem to be holding up really well. If Michael Jackson and Queen are worth over $1 billion, given these statistics, do you think that a Coldplay catalog would be worth something in that neighborhood or maybe even more? I don't know. Something's got to give in the difference between catalog value and what people are actually listening to. And this chart really underscores it.
I think there's a few things, right? Music that people listen to initially off the get-go and then getting a sense for what the shelf life of that music is after its initial commercial run. That's where the nuance comes with some of these catalog sales. We can obviously see the lasting legacy of Mr. Brightside today. You go back to 2003, it can feel a bit tough in the moment to confidently say, hey, if you were going to invest in one song, you would rather own Mr. Brightside than Linkin Park Crawling. Like, it may seem obvious now in hindsight, but in the moment, it can feel a little bit tougher, or you would rather own that song, Good Charlotte, the anthem, right? I think it can be tough to get a sense for, okay, what is going to be the anthem 10 plus years from now? Which one is this prisoner of the moment? Like we said with the Coldplay conversation, I'm with you. I think that especially on the recording side of that catalog, there's definitely probably more value than people realize. Publishing can get a bit fuzzy there, but yeah, the sweet spot, that early 2000s stuff, especially once you go back 10, 15 years, the stuff that really is proven, the amount that stuff and even the 2010 stuff does better than the 90s and 80s stuff probably doesn't get talked about enough.
How much of this has to do with the quantity of music being released, right? In the 60s, 70s, 80s, into the 90s, you were putting out music on vinyl and then on CDs, and there was this like physical constraint. And it would make more sense to allocate your resources around a smaller number of artists and put all your effort into that. The narrow scope of media channels also dictated that there could only be so many artists who, you know, who could get mind share. There wasn't this profusion of indie and DIY acts that came with the introduction of the internet. I mean, you can just upload your stuff directly without going through any kind of label or distributor. I would guess that the top 5 or 10 acts of each decade make up a disproportionate amount of the 80s and 90s and even the 2000s as compared to the 2010s and the 2020s.
Yeah, and there's data that supports that. So yeah, no, I agree with that 100%. I think that's a good call out. It would have been short-sighted not to mention that in this discussion. It was a couple years ago when there was some Billboard article that came out that said that Drake, the year that Certified Lover Boy came out, his music was streamed more in that year than all the music that had came out pre-1980. Of course, that's just one artist, but people seemed surprised by that. It actually isn't that surprising when you just think about the popularity of his catalog, especially during the streaming era. And then the fact that he put out a huge record during lockdown. So this is kind of how these things work. All right, well, Zach, this was fun. Appreciate you coming on.
For sure, as always.
And that's a wrap for today's episode. Thanks for joining us for our streaming surprises. And if you have any surprises yourself, would love to hear them. Send us a note. Email me at podcast@trapital.com. We'd love to hear if there's anything that has always surprised you about some of the streaming data here. Thanks again for Zach O'Malley-Greenberg for joining me on this one. Thanks again to our producers, Eric and G, for your producing of both the audio and video to make everything with Trapital possible. And thank you for listening. Most importantly, if there's one person you know that would really enjoy this show, send them a link to this episode. Send them a link to Trapital in general. Word of mouth is still the best way for this show to grow and reach the right people. Thanks again. Talk to you next time.